And on taking leave of the governor's wife, when she again smilingly said to him, "Well then, remember," he drew her aside. "But see here, to tell you the truth, aunt..." "What is it, my dear? Come, let's sit down here," said she. Nicholas suddenly felt a desire and need to tell his most intimate thoughts, which he would not have told to his mother, his sister, or his friend, to this woman who was almost a stranger. When he afterwards recalled that impulse to unsolicited and inexplicable frankness which had very important results for him, it seemed to him, as it seems to everyone in such cases, that it was merely some silly whim that seized him. Yet that burst of frankness, together with other trifling events, had immense consequences for him and for all his family. "You see, Aunt, Mama has long wanted me to marry an heiress, but the very idea of marrying for money is repugnant to me."
"Oh, yes, I understand," said the governor's wife.
"But Princess Bolkonskaya, that's another matter. I will tell you the truth. In the first place, I like her very much. I feel drawn to her. And then, after I met her under such circumstances, so strangely, the idea often occurred to me, this is fate. Especially if you remember that Mama had long been thinking of it. But I'd never happened to meet her before. Somehow it had always happened that we did not meet, and as long as my sister Natasha was engaged to her brother, it was of course out of the question for me to think of marrying her. And it must needs happen that I should meet her just when Natasha's engagement had been broken off. And then everything... So you see, I never told this to anyone, and never will, only to you." The governor's wife pressed his elbow gratefully. "You know Sonia, my cousin? I love her and promised to marry her, and will do so. So you see, there can be no question about..." said Nicholas incoherently and blushing.
"My dear boy, what a way to look at it! You know Sonia has nothing, and you yourself say your papa's affairs are in a very bad way. And what about your mother? It would kill her, that's one thing. And what sort of life would it be for Sonia if she's a girl with a heart? Your mother in despair, and you all ruined. No, my dear boy, you and Sonia ought to understand that."
Nicholas remained silent. It comforted him to hear these arguments.
"All the same, aunt, it is impossible," he rejoined with a sigh after a short pause. "Besides, would the princess have me? And besides, she's now in mourning. How can one think of it?
But you don't suppose I'm going to get you married at once?"
"There is always a right way of doing things," replied the governor's wife.
"What a matchmaker you are, aunt," said Nicholas, kissing her plump little hand. On reaching Moscow, after her meeting with Rostov, Princess Mary had found her nephew there with his tutor, and a letter from Prince Andrew giving her instructions how to get to her Aunt Malvintseva at Voronezh. That feeling akin to temptation which had tormented her during her father's illness, since his death, and especially since her meeting with Rostov, was smothered by arrangements for the journey, anxiety about her brother, settling in a new house, meeting new people, and attending to her nephew's education. She was sad. Now, after a month passed in quiet surroundings, she felt more and more deeply the loss of her father, which was associated in her mind with the ruin of Russia. She was agitated and incessantly tortured by the thought of the dangers to which her brother, the only intimate person now remaining to her, was exposed. She was worried, too, about her nephew's education, for which she had always felt herself incompetent. But in the depths of her soul, she felt at peace. A peace arising from consciousness of having stifled those personal dreams and hopes that had been on the point of awaking within her and were related to her meeting with Rostov. The day after her party, the governor's wife came to see Malvintseva, and after discussing her plan with the aunt, remarked that though under present circumstances a formal betrothal was of course not to be thought of, all the same the young people might be brought together and could get to know one another. Malvintseva expressed approval, and the governor's wife began to speak of Rostov in Mary's presence, praising him and telling how he had blushed when Princess Mary's name was mentioned. But Princess Mary experienced a painful rather than a joyful feeling. Her mental tranquility was destroyed, and desires, doubts, self-reproach, and hopes reawoke. During the 2 days that elapsed before Rostov called, Princess Mary continually thought of how she ought to behave to him. First, she decided not to come to the drawing room when he called to see her aunt, that it would not be proper for her in her deep mourning to receive visitors. Then she thought this would be rude after what he had done for her. Then it occurred to her that her aunt and the governor's wife had intentions concerning herself and Rostov. Their looks and words at times seemed to confirm this supposition. Then she told herself that only she, with her sinful nature, could think this of them. They could not forget that, situated as she was, while still wearing deep mourning, such matchmaking would be an insult to her and to her father's memory. Assuming that she did go down to see him, Princess Mary imagined the words he would say to her and what she would say to him. And these words sometimes seemed undeservedly cold, and then to mean too much. More than anything, she feared lest the confusion she felt might overwhelm her and betray her as soon as she saw him. But when on Sunday after church the footman announced in the drawing room that Count Rostov had called, the princess showed no confusion. Only a slight blush suffused her cheeks, and her eyes lit up with a new and radiant light. "You have met him, aunt?" said she in a calm voice, unable herself to understand that she could be outwardly so calm and natural. When Rostov entered the room, the princess dropped her eyes for an instant as if to give the visitor time to greet her aunt. And then, just as Nicholas turned to her, she raised her head and met his look with shining eyes. With a movement full of dignity and grace, she half rose with a smile of pleasure, held out her slender, delicate hand to him, and began to speak in a voice in which, for the first time, new, deep, womanly notes vibrated. Mademoiselle Bourienne, who was in the drawing-room, looked at Princess Mary in bewildered surprise. Herself a consummate coquette, she could not have maneuvered better on meeting a man she wished to attract. Either black is particularly becoming to her, or she really has greatly improved without my having noticed it. And above all, what tact and grace, thought Mademoiselle Bourienne. Had Princess Mary been capable of reflection at that moment, she would have been more surprised than Mademoiselle Bourienne at the change that had taken place in herself. From the moment she recognized that dear, loved face, a new life force took possession of her and compelled her to speak and act apart from her own will. From the time Rostov entered, her face became suddenly transformed. It was as if a light had been kindled in a carved and painted lantern, and the intricate, skillful, artistic work on its sides that previously seemed dark, coarse, and meaningless was suddenly shown up in unexpected and striking beauty. For the first time, all that pure, spiritual, inward travail through which she had lived appeared on the surface. All her inward labor, her dissatisfaction with herself, her sufferings, her strivings after goodness, her meekness, love, and self-sacrifice, all this now shone in those radiant eyes, in her delicate smile, and in every trait of her gentle face. Rostov saw all this as clearly as if he had known her whole life. He felt that the being before him was quite different from and better than anyone he had met before, and above all, better than himself. Their conversation was very simple and unimportant. They spoke of the war, and, like everyone else, unconsciously exaggerated their sorrow about it. They spoke of their last meeting, Nicholas trying to change the subject. They talked of the governor's kind wife, of Nicholas's relations, and of Princess Mary's. She did not talk about her brother, diverting the conversation as soon as her aunt mentioned Andrew. Evidently, she could speak of Russia's misfortunes with a certain artificiality, but her brother was too near her heart, and she neither could nor would speak lightly of him. Nicholas noticed this, as he noticed every shade of Princess Mary's character with an observation unusual to him, and everything confirmed his conviction that she was a quite unusual and extraordinary being. Nicholas blushed and was confused when people spoke to him about the princess, as she did when he was mentioned, and even when he thought of her. But in her presence he felt quite at ease, and said not at all what he had prepared, but what quite appropriately occurred to him at the moment. When a pause occurred during the short visit, Nicholas, as is usual when there are children, turned to Prince Andrew's little son, caressing him and asking whether he would like to be an hussar. He took the boy on his knee, played with him, and looked round at Princess Mary. With a softened, happy, and timid look, she watched the boy she loved in the arms of the man she loved. Nicholas also noticed that look, and, as if understanding it, flushed with pleasure, and began to kiss the boy with good-natured playfulness. As she was in mourning, Princess Mary did not go out into society, and Nicholas did not think it the proper thing to visit her again. But all the same, the governor's wife went on with her matchmaking, passing on to Nicholas the flattering things Princess Mary said of him, and vice versa, and insisting on his declaring himself to Princess Mary. For this purpose, she arranged a meeting between the young people at the bishop's house before Mass. Though Rostov told the governor's wife that he would not make any declaration to Princess Mary, he promised to go. As at Tilsit Rostov had not allowed himself to doubt that what everybody considered right was right, so now, after a short but sincere struggle between his effort to arrange his life by his own sense of justice and in obedient submission to circumstances, he chose the latter and yielded to the power he felt irresistibly carrying him he knew not where. He knew that after his promise to Sonya, it would be what he deemed base to declare his feelings to Princess Mary. And he knew that he would never act basely. But he also knew, or rather felt at the bottom of his heart, that by resigning himself now to the force of circumstances and to those who were guiding him, he was not only doing nothing wrong, but was doing something very, very important, more important than anything he'd ever done in his life. After meeting Princess Mary, though the course of his life went on externally as before, all his former amusements lost their charm for him, and he often thought about her. But he never thought about her as he had thought of all the young ladies without exception whom he had met in society, nor as he had for a long time, and at one time rapturously, thought about Sonya. He had pictured each of these young ladies as almost all honest-hearted young men do, that is, as a possible wife, adapting her in his imagination to all the conditions of married life. A white dressing gown, his wife at the tea table, his wife's carriage, little ones, Mama and Papa, their relations to her, and so on. And these pictures of the future had given him pleasure. But with Princess Mary, to whom they were trying to get him engaged, he could never picture anything of future married life. If he tried, his pictures seemed incongruous and false. It made him afraid. The dreadful news of the Battle of Borodino, of our losses in killed and wounded, and the still more terrible news of the loss of Moscow, reached Voronezh in the middle of September. Princess Mary, having learned of her brother's wound only from the Gazette, and having no definite news of him, prepared, so Nicholas heard, he had not seen her again himself, to set off in search of Prince Andrew. When he received the news of the Battle of Borodino and the abandonment of Moscow, Rostov was not seized with despair, anger, the desire for vengeance, or any feeling of that kind, but everything in Voronezh suddenly seemed to him dull and tiresome, and he experienced an indefinite feeling of shame and awkwardness. The conversations he heard seemed to him insincere. He did not know how to judge all these affairs, and felt that only in the regiment would everything again become clear to him. He made haste to finish buying the horses, and often became unreasonably angry with his servant and squadron quartermaster. A few days before his departure, a special thanksgiving at which Nicholas was present was held in the cathedral for the Russian victory. He stood a little behind the governor, and held himself with military decorum through the service, meditating on a great variety of subjects. When the service was over, the governor's wife beckoned him to her. "Have you seen the princess?" she asked, indicating with a movement of her head a lady standing on the opposite side beyond the choir. Nicholas immediately recognized Princess Mary, not so much by the profile he saw under her bonnet, as by the feeling of solicitude, timidity, and pity that immediately overcame him. Princess Mary, evidently engrossed by her thoughts, was crossing herself for the last time before leaving the church. Nicholas looked at her face with surprise. It was the same face he had seen before. There was the same general expression of refined inner spiritual labor, but now it was quite differently lit up. There was a pathetic expression of sorrow, prayer, and hope in it. As had occurred before when she was present, Nicholas went up to her without waiting to be prompted by the governor's wife, and not asking himself whether or not it was right and proper to address her here in church, and told her he had heard of her trouble and sympathized with his whole soul. As soon as she heard his voice, a vivid glow kindled in her face, lighting up both her sorrow and her joy. "There is one thing I wanted to tell you, Princess," said Rostov. "It is that if your brother, Prince Andrew Nikolaevich, were not living, it would have been at once announced in the Gazette, as he is a colonel." The princess looked at him, not grasping what he was saying, but cheered by the expression of regretful sympathy on his face. "And I've known so many cases of a splinter wound," the Gazette said it was a shell, "either proving fatal at once or being very slight," continued Nicholas. "We must hope for the best, and I'm sure..." Princess Mary interrupted him. "Oh, that would be so dread..." she began, and prevented by agitation from finishing, she bent her head with a movement as graceful as everything she did in his presence, and, looking up at him gratefully, went out, following her aunt. That evening, Nicholas did not go out, but stayed at home to settle some accounts with the horse dealers. When he had finished that business, it was already too late to go anywhere, but still too early to go to bed, and for a long time he paced up and down the room, reflecting on his life, a thing he rarely did. Princess Mary had made an agreeable impression on him when he had met her in Smolensk province. His having encountered her in such exceptional circumstances, and his mother having at one time mentioned her to him as a good match, had drawn his particular attention to her. When he met her again in Voronezh, the impression she made on him was not merely pleasing, but powerful. Nicholas had been struck by the peculiar moral beauty he observed in her at this time. He was, however, preparing to go away, and it had not entered his head to regret that he was thus depriving himself of chances of meeting her. But that day's encounter in church had, he felt, sunk deeper than was desirable for his peace of mind. That pale, sad, refined face, that radiant look, those gentle, graceful gestures, and especially the deep and tender sorrow expressed in all her features, agitated him and evoked his sympathy. In men, Rostov could not bear to see the expression of a higher spiritual life. That was why he did not like Prince Andrew, and he referred to it contemptuously as philosophy and dreaminess. But in Princess Mary, that very sorrow which revealed the depth of a whole spiritual world foreign to him was an irresistible attraction. "She must be a wonderful woman, a real angel," he said to himself. "Why am I not free? Why was I in such a hurry with Sonya?" And he involuntarily compared the two, the lack of spirituality in the one and the abundance of it in the other, a spirituality he himself lacked and therefore valued most highly. He tried to picture what would happen were he free, how he would propose to her, and how she would become his wife. But no, he could not imagine that. He felt awed, and no clear picture presented itself to his mind. He had long ago pictured to himself a future with Sonya, and that was all clear and simple just because it had all been thought out and he knew all there was in Sonya. But it was impossible to picture a future with Princess Mary because he did not understand her, but simply loved her. Reveries about Sonya had had something merry and playful in them, but to dream of Princess Mary was always difficult and a little frightening. "How she prayed," he thought. It was plain that her whole soul was in her prayer. Yes, that was the prayer that moves mountains, and I'm sure her prayer will be answered. Why don't I pray for what I want? He suddenly thought. What do I want? To be free, released from Sonya. She was right, he thought, remembering what the governor's wife had said. Nothing but misfortune can come of marrying Sonya. Muddles, grief for Mama, business difficulties. Muddles, terrible muddles. Besides, I don't love her. Not as I should. Oh, God, release me from this dreadful, inextricable position, he suddenly began to pray. Yes, prayer can move mountains, but one must have faith and not pray as Natasha and I used to as children, that the snow might turn into sugar, and then run out into the yard to see whether it had done so. No, but I'm not praying for trifles now, he thought, as he put his pipe down in a corner, and folding his hands, placed himself before the icon. Softened by memories of Princess Mary, he began to pray as he had not done for a long time. Tears were in his eyes and in his throat when the door opened and Lavrushka came in with some papers.
Blockhead, why do you come in without being called? Cried Nicholas, quickly changing his attitude.
From the governor, said Lavrushka in a sleepy voice. Courier has arrived, and there's a letter for you.
Well, all right, thanks. You can go.
Nicholas took the two letters, one of which was from his mother and the other from Sonya. He recognized them by the handwriting and opened Sonya's first. He had read only a few lines when he turned pale and his eyes opened wide with fear and joy. No, it's not possible, he cried aloud. Unable to sit still, he paced up and down the room holding the letter and reading it. He glanced through it, then read it again, and then again. And standing still in the middle of the room, he raised his shoulders, stretching out his hands, with his mouth wide open and his eyes fixed. What he had just been praying for, with confidence that God would hear him, had come to pass. But Nicholas was as much astonished as if it were something extraordinary and unexpected, and as if the very fact that it had happened so quickly proved that it had not come from God to whom he had prayed, but by some ordinary coincidence. This unexpected, and as it seemed to Nicholas quite voluntary letter from Sonya, freed him from the knot that fettered him, and from which there had seemed no escape. She wrote that the last unfortunate events, the loss of almost the whole of the Rostovs' Moscow property, and the Countess's repeatedly expressed wish that Nicholas should marry Princess Bolkonskaya, together with his silence and coldness of late, had all combined to make her decide to release him from his promise and set him completely free. It would be too painful to me to think that I might be a cause of sorrow or discord in the family that has been so good to me, she wrote. And my love has no aim but the happiness of those I love. So, Nicholas, I beg you to consider yourself free and to be assured that, in spite of everything, no one can love you more than does your Sonya. Both letters were written from Troitsa. The other, from the Countess, described their last days in Moscow, their departure, the fire, and the destruction of all their property. In this letter, the Countess also mentioned that Prince Andrew was among the wounded traveling with them. His state was very critical, but the doctor said there was now more hope. Sonya and Natasha were nursing him. Next day, Nicholas took his mother's letter and went to see Princess Mary. Neither he nor she said a word about what Natasha nursing him might mean. But thanks to this letter, Nicholas suddenly became almost as intimate with the princess as if they were relations. The following day, he saw Princess Mary off on her journey to Yaroslavl, and a few days later left to rejoin his regiment. Sonya's letter written from Troitsa, which had come as an answer to Nicholas's prayer, was prompted by this. The thought of getting Nicholas married to an heiress occupied the old countess's mind more and more. She knew that Sonya was the chief obstacle to this happening, and Sonya's life in the countess's house had grown harder and harder, especially after they had received a letter from Nicholas telling of his meeting with Princess Mary in Boguchárovo. The countess let no occasion slip of making humiliating or cruel allusions to Sonya. But a few days before they left Moscow, moved and excited by all that was going on, she called Sonya to her, and instead of reproaching and making demands on her, tearfully implored her to sacrifice herself and repay all that the family had done for her by breaking off her engagement with Nicholas. "I shall not be at peace till you promise me this." Sonya burst into hysterical tears and replied through her sobs that she would do anything and was prepared for anything, but gave no actual promise and could not bring herself to decide to do what was demanded of her. She must sacrifice herself for the family that had reared and brought her up. To sacrifice herself for others was Sonya's habit. Her position in the house was such that only by sacrifice could she show her worth, and she was accustomed to this and loved doing it. But in all her former acts of self-sacrifice, she had been happily conscious that they raised her in her own esteem and in that of others, and so made her more worthy of Nicholas, whom she loved more than anything in the world. But now they wanted her to sacrifice the very thing that constituted the whole reward for her self-sacrifice and the whole meaning of her life. And for the first time, she felt bitterness against those who had been her benefactors only to torture her the more painfully. She felt jealous of Natasha, who had never experienced anything of this sort, had never needed to sacrifice herself, but made others sacrifice themselves for her, and yet was beloved by everybody. And for the first time, Sonya felt that out of her pure, quiet love for Nicholas, a passionate feeling was beginning to grow up which was stronger than principle, virtue, or religion. Under the influence of this feeling, Sonya, whose life of dependence had taught her involuntarily to be secretive, having answered the Countess in vague general terms, avoided talking with her and resolved to wait till she should see Nicholas, not in order to set him free, but on the contrary, at that meeting to bind him to her forever. The bustle and terror of the Rostovs' last days in Moscow stifled the gloomy thoughts that oppressed Sonya. She was glad to find escape from them in practical activity. But when she heard of Prince Andrew's presence in their house, despite her sincere pity for him and for Natasha, she was seized by a joyful and superstitious feeling that God did not intend her to be separated from Nicholas. She knew that Natasha loved no one but Prince Andrew and had never ceased to love him. She knew that being thrown together again under such terrible circumstances, they would again fall in love with one another, and that Nicholas would then not be able to marry Princess Mary, as they would be within the prohibited degrees of affinity. Despite all the terror of what had happened during those last days and during the first days of their journey, this feeling that Providence was intervening in her personal affairs cheered Sonya. At the Troitsa Monastery, the Rostovs first broke their journey for a whole day. Three large rooms were assigned to them in the monastery hostelry, one of which was occupied by Prince Andrew. The wounded man was much better that day, and Natasha was sitting with him. In the next room sat the Count and Countess respectfully conversing with the prior, who was calling on them as old acquaintances and benefactors of the monastery. Sonya was there too, tormented by curiosity as to what Prince Andrew and Natasha were talking about. She heard the sound of their voices through the door. That door opened, and Natasha came out looking excited. Not noticing the monk, who had risen to greet her and was drawing back the wide sleeve on his right arm, she went up to Sonya and took her hand. "Natasha, what are you about? Come here," said the Countess. Natasha went up to the monk for his blessing, and he advised her to turn for aid to God and his saint. As soon as the prior withdrew, Natasha took her friend by the hand and went with her into the unoccupied room. "Sonya, will he live?" she asked. "Sonya, how happy I am, and how unhappy. Sonya, dovey, everything is as it used to be. If only he lives. He cannot, because of..." And Natasha burst into tears. "Yes, I knew it. Thank God," murmured Sonya. "He will live." Sonya was not less agitated than her friend by the latter's fear and grief, and by her own personal feelings, which she shared with no one. Sobbing, she kissed and comforted Natasha. "If only he lives," she thought. Having wept, talked, and wiped away their tears, the two friends went together to Prince Andrew's door. Natasha opened it cautiously and glanced into the room. Sonya standing beside her at the half-open door. Prince Andrew was lying raised high on three pillows. His pale face was calm, his eyes closed, and they could see his regular breathing.
"Oh, Natasha!"
Sonya suddenly almost screamed, catching her companion's arm and stepping back from the door.
"What? What is it?" asked Natasha. "It's that! That!"
said Sonya with a white face and trembling lips. Natasha softly closed the door and went with Sonya to the window, not yet understanding what the latter was telling her.
"You remember?" said Sonya with a solemn and frightened expression. "You remember when I looked in the mirror for you? At Otradnoye, at Christmas? Do you remember what I saw?"
"Yes. Yes," cried Natasha, opening her eyes wide and vaguely recalling that Sonya had told her something about Prince Andrew, whom she had seen lying down.
"You remember?" Sonya went on. "I saw it then and told everybody, you and Dunyasha. I saw him lying on a bed," said she, making a gesture with her hand and a lifted finger at each detail, "and that he had his eyes closed and was covered just with a pink quilt, and that his hands were folded," she concluded, convincing herself that the details she had just seen were exactly what she had seen in the mirror. She had in fact seen nothing then, but had mentioned the first thing that came into her head, but what she had invented then seemed to her now as real as any other recollection. She not only remembered what she had then said, that he turned to look at her and smiled and was covered with something red, but was firmly convinced that she had then seen and said that he was covered with a pink quilt and that his eyes were closed. "Yes, yes, it really was pink," cried Natasha, who now thought she too remembered the word pink being used, and saw in this the most extraordinary and mysterious part of the prediction.
"But what does it mean?" she added meditatively.
"Oh, I don't know, it's all so strange," replied Sonya, clutching at her head.
A few minutes later, Prince Andrew rang, and Natasha went to him. But Sonya, feeling unusually excited and touched, remained at the window, thinking about the strangeness of what had occurred. They had an opportunity that day to send letters to the army, and the Countess was writing to her son.
"Sonya," said the Countess, raising her eyes from her letter as her niece passed. "Sonya, won't you write to Nicholas?"
She spoke in a soft, tremulous voice, and in the weary eyes that looked over her spectacles, Sonya read all that the Countess meant to convey with these words. Those eyes expressed entreaty, shame at having to ask, fear of a refusal, and readiness for relentless hatred in case of such refusal. Sonya went up to the Countess and, kneeling down, kissed her hand.
"Yes, Mama, I will write," said she.
Sonya was softened, excited, and touched by all that had occurred that day, especially by the mysterious fulfillment she had just seen of her vision. Now that she knew that the renewal of Natasha's relations with Prince Andrew would prevent Nicholas from marrying Princess Mary, she was joyfully conscious of a return of that self-sacrificing spirit in which she was accustomed to live and loved to live. So, with a joyful consciousness of performing a magnanimous deed, interrupted several times by the tears that dimmed her velvety black eyes, she wrote that touching letter, the arrival of which had so amazed Nicholas. Chapter 3. Pierre's treatment as a prisoner. He is questioned by Davout. Shooting of prisoners. Platon Karatayev. The officer and soldiers who had arrested Pierre treated him with hostility, but yet with respect, in the guardhouse to which he was taken. In their attitude toward him could still be felt both uncertainty as to who he might be, perhaps a very important person, and hostility as a result of their recent personal conflict with him. But when the guard was relieved next morning, Pierre felt that for the new guard, both officers and men, he was not as interesting as he had been to his captors. And in fact, the guard of the second day did not recognize in this big, stout man in a peasant coat the vigorous person who had fought so desperately with the marauder and the convoy, and had uttered those solemn words about saving a child. They saw in him only number 17 of the captured Russians, arrested and detained for some reason by order of the higher command. If they noticed anything remarkable about Pierre, it was only his unabashed meditative concentration and thoughtfulness, and the way he spoke French, which struck them as surprisingly good. In spite of this, he was placed that day with the other arrested suspects, as the separate room he had occupied was required by an officer. All the Russians confined with Pierre were men of the lowest class, and recognizing him as a gentleman, they all avoided him, more especially as he spoke French. Pierre felt sad at hearing them making fun of him. That evening, he learned that all these prisoners, he probably among them, were to be tried for incendiarism. On the third day, he was taken with the others to a house where a French general with a white mustache sat with two colonels and other Frenchmen with scarves on their arms. With the precision and definiteness customary in addressing prisoners, and which is supposed to preclude human frailty, Pierre, like the others, was questioned as to who he was, where he had been, with what object, and so on. These questions, like questions put at trials generally, left the essence of the matter aside, shut out the possibility of that essence as being revealed, and were designed only to form a channel through which the judges wished the answers of the accused to flow so as to lead to the desired result, namely, a conviction. As soon as Pierre began to say anything that did not fit in with that aim, the channel was removed and the water could flow to waste. Pierre felt, moreover, what the accused always feel at their trial, perplexity as to why these questions were put to him. He had a feeling that it was only out of condescension or a kind of civility that this device of placing a channel was employed. He knew he was in these men's power, that only by force had they brought him there, that force alone gave them the right to demand answers to their questions, and that the sole object of that assembly was to inculpate him. And so, as they had the power and wish to inculpate him, this expedient of an inquiry and trial seemed unnecessary. It was evident that any answer would lead to conviction. When asked what he was doing when he was arrested, Pierre replied in a rather tragic manner that he was restoring to its parents a child he had saved from the flames. Why had he fought the marauder? Pierre answered that he was protecting a woman, and that to protect a woman who was being insulted was the duty of every man, that they interrupted him, for this was not to the point. Why was he in the yard of a burning house where witnesses had seen him? He replied that he had gone out to see what was happening in Moscow. Again they interrupted him. They had not asked where he was going, but why he was found near the fire. Who was he, they asked, repeating their first question, which he had declined to answer. Again he replied that he could not answer it. Put that down, that's bad. Very bad, sternly remarked the general with a white mustache and red flushed face. On the fourth day, fires broke out on the Zubovsky rampart. Pierre and 13 others were moved to the coach house of a merchant's house near the Crimean bridge. On his way through the streets, Pierre felt stifled by the smoke which seemed to hang over the whole city. Fires were visible on all sides. He did not then realize the significance of the burning of Moscow and looked at the fires with horror. He passed 4 days in the coach house near the Crimean bridge, and during that time learned from the talk of the French soldiers that all those confined there were awaiting a decision which might come any day from the marshal. What marshal this was, Pierre could not learn from the soldiers. Evidently for them, the marshal represented a very high and rather mysterious power. These first days, before the 8th of September, when the prisoners were had up for a second examination, were the hardest of all for Pierre. On the 8th of September, an officer, a very important one judging by the respect the guard showed him, entered the coach house where the prisoners were. This officer, probably someone on the staff, was holding a paper in his hand and called over all the Russians there, naming Pierre as the man who does not give his name. Glancing indolently and indifferently at all the prisoners, he ordered the officer in charge to have them decently dressed and tidied up before taking them to the marshal. An hour later, a squad of soldiers arrived, and Pierre, with 13 others, was led to the Virgin's Field. It was a fine day, sunny after rain, and the air was unusually pure. The smoke did not hang low as on the day when Pierre had been taken from the guardhouse on the Zubovsky rampart, but rose through the pure air in columns. No flames were seen, but columns of smoke rose on all sides, and all Moscow, as far as Pierre could see, was one vast, charred ruin. On all sides, there were waste spaces, with only stoves and chimney stacks still standing, and here and there the blackened walls of some brick houses. Pierre gazed at the ruins and did not recognize districts he had known well. Here and there he could see churches that had not been burned. The Kremlin, which was not destroyed, gleamed white in the distance, with its towers and the belfry of Ivan the Great. The domes of the new convent of the Virgin glittered brightly, and its bells were ringing particularly clearly. These bells reminded Pierre that it was Sunday and the feast of the Nativity of the Virgin. But there seemed to be no one to celebrate this holiday. Everywhere were blackened ruins, and the few Russians to be seen were tattered and frightened people who tried to hide when they saw the French. It was plain that the Russian nest was ruined and destroyed. But in place of the Russian order of life that had been destroyed, Pierre unconsciously felt that a quite different, firm French order had been established over this ruined nest. He felt this in the looks of the soldiers, who, marching in regular ranks briskly and gaily, were escorting him and the other criminals. He felt it in the looks of an important French official in a carriage and pair driven by a soldier whom they met on the way. He felt it in the merry sounds of regimental music he heard from the left side of the field, and felt and realized it especially from the list of prisoners the French officer had read out when he came that morning. Pierre had been taken by one set of soldiers and led first to one and then to another place with dozens of other men, and it seemed that they might have forgotten him or confused him with the others. But no, the answers he had given when questioned had come back to him in his designation as the man who does not give his name. And under that appellation, which to Pierre seemed terrible, they were now leading him somewhere with unhesitating assurance on their faces that he and all the other prisoners were exactly the ones they wanted and that they were being taken to the proper place. Pierre felt himself to be an insignificant chip fallen among the wheels of a machine whose action he did not understand, but which was working well. He and the other prisoners were taken to the right side of the Virgin's Field, to a large white house with an immense garden not far from the convent. This was Prince Shcherbatov's house, where Pierre had often been in other days, and which, as he learned from the talk of the soldiers, was now occupied by the marshal, the Duke of Eckmühl, Davout. They were taken to the entrance and led into the house one by one. Pierre was the sixth to enter. He was conducted through a glass gallery, an anteroom, and a hall which were familiar to him, into a long, low study, at the door of which stood an adjutant. Davout, spectacles on nose, sat bent over a table at the further end of the room. Pierre went close up to him, but Davout, evidently consulting a paper that lay before him, did not look up. Without raising his eyes, he said in a low voice, "Who are you?" Pierre was silent because he was incapable of uttering a word. To him, Davout was not merely a French general, but a man notorious for his cruelty. Looking at his cold face, as he sat like a stern schoolmaster who was preparing to wait a while for an answer, Pierre felt that every instant of delay might cost him his life. But he did not know what to say. He did not venture to repeat what he had said at his first examination, yet to disclose his rank and position was dangerous and embarrassing. So he was silent. But before he had decided what to do, Davout raised his head, pushed his spectacles back on his forehead, screwed up his eyes, and looked intently at him. "I know that man," he said in a cold, measured tone, evidently calculated to frighten Pierre. The chill that had been running down Pierre's back now seized his head as in a vice. "You cannot know me, General. I've never seen you." "He is a Russian spy," Davout interrupted, addressing another general who was present but whom Pierre had not noticed. Davout turned away. With an unexpected reverberation in his voice, Pierre rapidly began, "No, Monseigneur," he said, suddenly remembering that Davout was a duke. "No, Monseigneur, you cannot have known me. I am a militia officer and have not quitted Moscow." "Your name?" asked Davout.
"Bezukhov."
"What proof have I that you are not lying?"
"Monseigneur,"
exclaimed Pierre, not in an offended but in a pleading voice. Davout looked up and gazed intently at him. For some seconds they looked at one another, and that look saved Pierre. Apart from conditions of war and law, that look established human relations between the two men. At that moment, an immense number of things passed dimly through both their minds, and they realized that they were both children of humanity and were brothers. At the first glance, when Davout had only raised his head from the papers where human affairs and lives were indicated by numbers, Pierre was merely a circumstance, and Davout could have shot him without burdening his conscience with an evil deed. But now he saw in him a human being. He reflected for a moment. "How can you show me that you are telling the truth?" said Davout coldly. Pierre remembered Rambal and named him and his regiment and the street where the house was. "You are not what you say," returned Davout. In a trembling, faltering voice, Pierre began adducing proofs of the truth of his statements. But at that moment an adjutant entered and reported something to Davout. Davout brightened up at the news the adjutant brought and began buttoning up his uniform. It seemed that he had quite forgotten Pierre. When the adjutant reminded him of the prisoner, he jerked his head in Pierre's direction with a frown and ordered him to be led away. But where they were to take him, Pierre did not know. Back to the coach house, or to the place of execution his companions had pointed out to him as they crossed the Virgin's Field. He turned his head and saw that the adjutant was putting another question to Davout. "Yes, of course," replied Davout. But what this yes meant, Pierre did not know. Pierre could not afterwards remember how he went, whether it was far or in what direction. His faculties were quite numbed. He was stupefied, and, noticing nothing around him, went on moving his legs as the others did till they all stopped and he stopped too. The only thought in his mind at that time was, who was it that had really sentenced him to death? Not the men on the commission that had first examined him. Not one of them had wished to or evidently could have done it. It was not Davout who had looked at him in so human a way. In another moment, Davout would have realized that he was doing wrong. But just then the adjutant had come in and interrupted him. The adjutant also had evidently had no evil intent, though he might have refrained from coming in. Then who was executing him, killing him, depriving him of life? Him, Pierre, with all his memories, aspirations, hopes, and thoughts. Who was doing this? And Pierre felt that it was no one. It was a system, a concurrence of circumstances. A system of some sort was killing him, Pierre, depriving him of life, of everything, annihilating him. From Prince Shcherbatov's house, the prisoners were led straight down the Virgin's Field to the left of the nunnery, as far as a kitchen garden in which a post had been set up. Beyond that post, a fresh pit had been dug in the ground, and near the post and the pit a large crowd stood in a semicircle. The crowd consisted of a few Russians and many of Napoleon's soldiers who were not on duty, Germans, Italians, and Frenchmen in a variety of uniforms. To the right and left of the post stood rows of French troops in blue uniforms with red epaulettes and high boots and shackles. The prisoners were placed in a certain order according to the list. Pierre was sixth, and were led to the post. Several drums suddenly began to beat on both sides of them, and at that sound Pierre felt as if part of his soul had been torn away. He lost the power of thinking or understanding. He could only hear and see. And he had only one wish, that the frightful thing that had to happen should happen quickly. Pierre looked round at his fellow prisoners and scrutinized them. The two first were convicts with shaven heads. One was tall and thin, the other dark, shaggy, and sinewy, with a flat nose. The third was a domestic serf about 45 years old, with grizzled hair and a plump, well-nourished body. The fourth was a peasant, a very handsome man, with a broad, light brown beard and black eyes. The fifth was a factory hand, a thin, sallow-faced lad of 18, in a loose coat. Pierre heard the French consulting whether to shoot them separately or two at a time. "In couples," replied the officer in command in a calm voice. There was a stir in the ranks of the soldiers, and it was evident that they were all hurrying, not as men hurry to do something they understand, but as people hurry to finish a necessary but unpleasant and incomprehensible task. A French official wearing a scarf came up to the right of the row of prisoners and read out the sentence in Russian and in French. Then two pairs of Frenchmen approached the criminals and, at the officer's command, took the two convicts who stood first in the row. The convicts stopped when they reached the post, and while sacks were being brought, looked dumbly around as a wounded beast looks at an approaching huntsman. One crossed himself continually, the other scratched his back and made a movement of the lips resembling a smile. With hurried hands, the soldiers blindfolded them, drawing the sacks over their heads, and bound them to the post. 12 sharpshooters with muskets stepped out of the ranks with a firm, regular tread and halted 8 paces from the post. Pierre turned away to avoid seeing what was going to happen. Suddenly a crackling, rolling noise was heard, which seemed to him louder than the most terrific thunder, and he looked round. There was some smoke, and the Frenchmen were doing something near the pit, with pale faces and trembling hands. 2 more prisoners were led up. In the same way, and with similar looks, these two glanced vainly at the onlookers with only a silent appeal for protection in their eyes, evidently unable to understand or believe what was going to happen to them. They could not believe it because they alone knew what their life meant to them, and so they neither understood nor believed that it could be taken from them. Again Pierre did not wish to look, and again turned away. But again the sound as of a frightful explosion struck his ear, and at the same moment he saw smoke, blood, and the pale, scared faces of the Frenchmen who were again doing something by the post, their trembling hands impeding one another. Pierre, breathing heavily, looked around as if asking what it meant. The same question was expressed in all the looks that met his. On the faces of all the Russians and of the French soldiers and officers, without exception, he read the same dismay, horror, and conflict that were in his own heart. But who, after all, is doing this? They are all suffering as I am. Who, then, is it? Who? Flashed for an instant through his mind.
Sharpshooters of the 86th, forward! Shouted someone.
The fifth prisoner, the one next to Pierre, was led away alone. Pierre did not understand that he was saved, that he and the rest had been brought there only to witness the execution. With ever-growing horror, and with no sense of joy or relief, he gazed at what was taking place. The fifth man was the factory lad in the loose cloak. The moment they laid hands on him, he sprang aside in terror and clutched at Pierre. Pierre shuddered and shook himself free. The lad was unable to walk. They dragged him along, holding him under the arms, and he screamed. When they got him to the post, he grew quiet, as if he suddenly understood something. Whether he understood that screaming was useless, or whether he thought it incredible that men should kill him, at any rate, he took his stand at the post, waiting to be blindfolded like the others, and like a wounded animal, looked around him with glittering eyes. Pierre was no longer able to turn away and close his eyes. His curiosity and agitation, like that of the whole crowd, reached the highest pitch at this fifth murder. Like the others, this fifth man seemed calm. He wrapped his loose cloak closer and rubbed one bare foot with the other. When they began to blindfold him, he himself adjusted the knot which hurt the back of his head. Then, when they propped him against the blood-stained post, he leaned back, and, not being comfortable in that position, straightened himself, adjusted his feet, and leaned back again more comfortably. Pierre did not take his eyes from him, and did not miss his slightest movement. Probably a word of command was given and was followed by the reports of 8 muskets, but try as he would, Pierre could not afterwards remember having heard the slightest sound of the shots. He only saw how the workman suddenly sank down on the cords that held him, how blood showed itself in 2 places, how the ropes slackened under the weight of the hanging body, and how the workman sat down, his head hanging unnaturally and 1 leg bent under him. Pierre ran up to the post. No one hindered him. Pale, frightened people were doing something around the workman. The lower jaw of an old Frenchman with a thick moustache trembled as he untied the ropes. The body collapsed. The soldiers dragged it awkwardly from the post and began pushing it into the pit. They all plainly and certainly knew that they were criminals who must hide the traces of their guilt as quickly as possible. Pierre glanced into the pit and saw that the factory lad was lying with his knees close up to his head and 1 shoulder higher than the other. That shoulder rose and fell rhythmically and convulsively, but spadefuls of earth were already being thrown over the whole body. 1 of the soldiers, evidently suffering, shouted gruffly and angrily at Pierre to go back, but Pierre did not understand him and remained near the post, and no one drove him away. When the pit had been filled up, a command was given. Pierre was taken back to his place, and the rows of troops on both sides of the post made a half turn and went past it at a measured pace. The 24 sharpshooters with discharged muskets standing in the center of the circle ran back to their places as the companies passed by. Pierre gazed now with dazed eyes at these sharpshooters who ran in couples out of the circle. All but 1 rejoined their companies. This one, a young soldier, his face deadly pale, his shako pushed back and his musket resting on the ground, still stood near the pit at the spot from which he had fired. He swayed like a drunken man, taking some steps forward and back to save himself from falling. An old non-commissioned officer ran out of the ranks and, taking him by the elbow, dragged him to his company. The crowd of Russians and Frenchmen began to disperse. They all went away silently and with drooping heads. "That will teach them to start fires," said 1 of the Frenchmen. Pierre glanced round at the speaker and saw that it was a soldier who was trying to find some relief after what had been done, but was not able to do so. Without finishing what he had begun to say, he made a hopeless movement with his arm and went away. After the execution, Pierre was separated from the rest of the prisoners and placed alone in a small, ruined, and befouled church. Toward evening, a non-commissioned officer entered with 2 soldiers and told him that he had been pardoned and would now go to the barracks for the prisoners of war. Without understanding what was said to him, Pierre got up and went with the soldiers. They took him to the upper end of the field, where there were some sheds built of charred planks, beams, and battens, and led him into 1 of them. In the darkness, some 20 different men surrounded Pierre. He looked at them without understanding who they were, why they were there, or what they wanted of him. He heard what they said, but did not understand the meaning of the words, and made no kind of deduction from or application of them. He replied to questions they put to him, but did not consider who was listening to his replies, nor how they would understand them. He looked at their faces and figures, but they all seemed to him equally meaningless. From the moment Pierre had witnessed those terrible murders committed by men who did not wish to commit them, it was as if the mainspring of his life, on which everything depended and which made everything appear alive, had suddenly been wrenched out, and everything had collapsed into a heap of meaningless rubbish. Though he did not acknowledge it to himself, his faith in the right ordering of the universe, in humanity, in his own soul, and in God, had been destroyed. He had experienced this before, but never so strongly as now. When similar doubts had assailed him before, they had been the result of his own wrongdoing, and at the bottom of his heart he had felt that relief from his despair and from those doubts was to be found within himself. But now he felt that the universe had crumbled before his eyes, and only meaningless ruins remained, and this not by any fault of his own. He felt that it was not in his power to regain faith in the meaning of life. Around him in the darkness, men were standing, and evidently something about him interested them greatly. They were telling him something and asking him something. Then they led him away somewhere, and at last he found himself in a corner of the shed among men who were laughing and talking on all sides.
"Well then, mates, that very prince who..."
some voice at the other end of the shed was saying, with a strong emphasis on the word who. Sitting silent and motionless on a heap of straw against the wall, Pierre sometimes opened and sometimes closed his eyes. But as soon as he closed them, he saw before him the dreadful face of the factory lad, especially dreadful because of its simplicity, and the faces of the murderers, even more dreadful because of their disquiet. And he opened his eyes again and stared vacantly into the darkness around him. Beside him, in a stooping position, sat a small man of whose presence he was first made aware by a strong smell of perspiration which came from him every time he moved. This man was doing something to his legs in the darkness, and though Pierre could not see his face, he felt that the man continually glanced at him. On growing used to the darkness, Pierre saw that the man was taking off his leg bands, and the way he did it aroused Pierre's interest. Having unwound the string that tied the band on one leg, he carefully coiled it up and immediately set to work on the other leg, glancing up at Pierre. While one hand hung up the first string, the other was already unwinding the band on the second leg. In this way, having carefully removed the leg bands by deft circular motions of his arm following one another uninterruptedly, the man hung the leg bands up on some pegs fixed above his head. Then he took out a knife, cut something, closed the knife, placed it under the head of his bed, and, seating himself comfortably, clasped his arms round his lifted knees and fixed his eyes on Pierre. The latter was conscious of something pleasant, comforting, and well-rounded in these deft movements, in the man's well-ordered arrangements in his corner, and even in his very smell, and he looked at the man without taking his eyes from him.
"You've seen a lot of trouble, sir, eh?"
the little man suddenly said. And there was so much kindliness and simplicity in his sing-song voice that Pierre tried to reply, but his jaw trembled and he felt tears rising to his eyes. The little fellow, giving Pierre no time to betray his confusion, instantly continued in the same pleasant tones.
"Hey, lad, don't fret,"
said he, in the tender sing-song caressing voice old Russian peasant women employ.
"Don't fret, friend. Suffer an hour, live for an age. That's how it is, my dear fellow. And here we live, thank heaven, without offense. Among these folk, too, there are good men as well as bad," said he.
And still speaking, he turned on his knees with a supple movement, got up, coughed, and went off to another part of the shed.
"Hey, you rascal," Pierre heard the same kind voice saying at the other end of the shed. "So you've come, you rascal. She remembers. Now, now, that'll do."
And the soldier, pushing away a little dog that was jumping up at him, returned to his place and sat down. In his hands, he had something wrapped in a rag.
"Here, eat a bit, sir," said he, resuming his former respectful tone as he unwrapped and offered Pierre some baked potatoes. "We had soup for dinner, and the potatoes are grand."
Pierre had not eaten all day, and the smell of the potatoes seemed extremely pleasant to him. He thanked the soldier and began to eat.
"Well, are they all right?" said the soldier with a smile.
"You should do like this."
He took a potato, drew out his clasp knife, cut the potato into two equal halves on the palm of his hand, sprinkled some salt on it from the rag, and handed it to Pierre.
"The potatoes are grand," he said once more. "Eat some like that."
Pierre thought he had never eaten anything that tasted better.
Oh, I'm all right, said he. But why did they shoot those poor fellows? The last one was hardly 20.
Said the little man. Ah, what a sin, what a sin, he added quickly. And as if his words were always waiting ready in his mouth and flew out involuntarily, he went on. How was it, sir, that you stayed in Moscow?
I didn't think they would come so soon. I stayed accidentally, replied Pierre.
And how did they arrest you, dear lad? At your house?
No, I went to look at the fire, and they arrested me there and tried me as an incendiary.
Where there's law, there's injustice, put in the little man.
And have you been here long? Pierre asked as he munched the last of the potato.
I? It was last Sunday they took me, out of a hospital in Moscow.
Why, are you a soldier then?
Yes, we are soldiers of the Apshiron regiment. I was dying of fever. We weren't told anything. There were some 20 of us lying there. We had no idea, never guessed at all.
And you feel sad here? Pierre inquired.
How can one help it, lad? My name is Platon, and the surname is Karatayev, he added, evidently wishing to make it easier for Pierre to address him. They call me Little Falcon in the regiment. How is one to help feeling sad? Moscow, she's the mother of cities. How can one see all this and not feel sad? But the maggot gnaws the cabbage, yet dies first. That's what the old folks used to tell us, he added rapidly.
What did you say? Asked Pierre.
Who, I? Said Karatayev. I say things happen not as we plan, but as God judges, he replied, thinking that he was repeating what he had said before, and immediately continued, Well, and you, have you a family estate, sir? And a house? So you have abundance, then? And a housewife? And your old parents, are they still living? He asked.
And though it was too dark for Pierre to see, he felt that a suppressed smile of kindliness puckered the soldier's lips as he put these questions. He seemed grieved that Pierre had no parents, especially that he had no mother.
A wife for counsel, a mother-in-law for welcome, but there's none as dear as one's own mother, said he.
Well, and have you little ones? He went on asking.
Again Pierre's negative answer seemed to distress him, and he hastened to add,
Never mind, you're young folks yet, and please God may still have some. The great thing is to live in harmony.
But it's all the same now, Pierre could not help saying.
Oh, my dear fellow, rejoined Karatayev, never decline a prison or a beggar's sack.
He seated himself more comfortably and coughed, evidently preparing to tell a long story.
Well, my dear fellow, I was still living at home, he began. We had a well-to-do homestead, plenty of land. We peasants lived well, and our house was one to thank God for. When Father and we went out mowing, there were 7 of us. We lived well. We were real peasants. It so happened,
and Platon Karatayev told a long story of how he had gone into someone's copse to take wood, how he had been caught by the keeper, had been tried, flogged, and sent to serve as a soldier.
Well, lad,
and a smile changed the tone of his voice, we thought it was a misfortune, but it turned out a blessing. If it had not been for my sin, my brother would have had to go as a soldier. But he, my younger brother, had 5 little ones, while I, you see, only left a wife behind. We had a little girl, but God took her before I went as a soldier. I come home on leave. I'll tell you how it was. I look and see that they're living better than before. The yard full of cattle, the women at home, 2 brothers away earning wages, and only Michael, the youngest, at home. Father, he says, all my children are the same to me. It hurts the same whichever finger gets bitten. But if Platon hadn't been shaved for a soldier, Michael would have had to go. He called us all to him, and will you believe it, placed us in front of the icons. Michael, he says, come here and bow down to his feet. And you, young woman,
you bow down too, and you grandchildren also bow down before him. Do you understand? He says. That's how it is, dear fellow. Fate looks for ahead. But we're always judging, that's not well, that's not right. Our luck is like water in a dragnet. You pull at it and it bulges, but when you've drawn it out, it's empty. That's how it is. And Platon shifted his seat on the straw. After a short silence, he rose. Well, I think you must be sleepy, said he, and began rapidly crossing himself and repeating, Lord Jesus Christ, Holy Saint Nicholas, Fräulein Lavra, Lord Jesus Christ, Holy Saint Nicholas, Fräulein Lavra, Lord Jesus Christ, have mercy on us and save us, he concluded, then bowed to the ground, got up, sighed, and sat down again on his heap of straw. That's the way. Lay me down like a stone, O God, and raise me up like a loaf, he muttered as he lay down, pulling his coat over him. What prayer was that you were saying? Asked Pierre. Muttered Platon, who had almost fallen asleep. What was I saying? I was praying. Don't you pray? Yes, I do, said Pierre, but what was that you said, Fräulein Lavra? Well, of course, replied Platon quickly. The horses, saints. One must pity the animals, too. The rascal, now you've curled up and got warm, you daughter of a bitch, said Karatayev, touching the dog that lay at his feet, and again turning over, he fell asleep immediately. Sounds of crying and screaming came from somewhere in the distance outside, and flames were visible through the cracks of the shed, but inside it was quiet and dark. For a long time Pierre did not sleep, but lay with eyes open in the darkness, listening to the regular snoring of Platon, who lay beside him. And he felt that the world that had been shattered was once more stirring in his soul with a new beauty and on new and unshakable foundations.